Welcome back, everyone, to the Reflex Blues Show. I am your host, Donovan Beery, and we are in some Chicago conference center back room, Grand Suite 1 or something, recording from the Howe Conference 2015, and I have with me our first guest of the number of these we'll be recording, Michael Beirut. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Donovan. How are you?
Good. Now, I'm assuming that the one thing that everyone wants you to talk about is the one thing you may or may not have been involved with recently, with some sort of new logo for some person that might be running for some...
No, I'm referring all questions about that to the campaign. I'll keep them focused on the candidate as opposed to on graphic design.
Okay. Yep. The minute I saw the logo, I thought the guys that redid the State Farm logo, I thought of them because it was very, very clean, simple, straightforward. The minute I saw it, I was like, that looks like something... GNC.
Yeah, sure, my guys, Myron.
And I like that design.
I think the older I get, the more I've come to appreciate simple things. Sort of. When I was younger, I sort of was addicted to cleverness, my own cleverness first and foremost. But I admired cleverness in other people, and then you sort of see the cleverness and complexity for its own sake sort of has a shelf life and doesn't wear as well as some things that just have been around for a long time.
I saw you speak when I was in college, and I remember, so this would have been probably, you came through Omaha, it was probably around 97 maybe. Yeah, I remember seeing your presentation and being like, yeah, that's pretty good, it's pretty good. And then like 10 years later you came to Des Moines and we drove down to see you. And I think some of your presentation is the same, and I didn't, midway through your presentation, I made the connection. I was like, oh, that's who I saw before. And I'm like, wow, the simplicity is, like, it took me 10 years in the profession to realize how hard it was.
Yeah, and also I may have been better the second time. I had better work or more work or improved.
No, I think it took me 10 years to realize
You know, particularly if you're talking about logo design or identity design, I've come really close to giving up trying to analyze how it really works, what makes it successful, because you know any logo that you talk about that you admire, what you're really talking about is seldom the thing itself. If you centered it on a piece of paper and just looked at it in the abstract, absent any context, you know, we're always just reacting to the world that has come to surround whatever that idea is, whether it's a logo for a political party, a candidate, a product, a company, an organization, institution. And the ones that are, sometimes complexity is nice. The Coca-Cola logo is really complex. And if you think about it, it sort of is meant to evoke kind of Americana and timelessness.
And if there wasn't 100 years of caffeine in my system, I don't know if I would like the logo or not. I mean, when you see it, it feels like it's from that era. You're right. You have so much backstory with it that I don't remember the first time I saw the logo.
Yeah,
it was probably, 2 months old or something.
But then the GE logo, which dates from about the same period, represents a really different sort of enterprise, which... You on the face of it doesn't need to partake of centuries of tradition in order to like make a good MRI scanner or turbine engine or dishwasher or all the different things that they might sell you or businesses that, in your community, and yet they sort of stuck with that kind of fairly quaint logo too. Part of the reason is I think they're both just well made things that people have invested a lot of meaning in over the years.
So when you go back and let's say, since you obviously did some research, what do you think the best political logo pre-1970 is? Was there anything good before that? Because I mean, now that with the Obama campaign started like a whole design trend, but I'm assuming you did some research. Is there stuff that was from the past that was well handled, or is?
No, the idea of doing like logos for candidates was. It's like fairly a new thing, and it's the requirement for them is actually dictated partly by things like the rise of social media and digital communications, where you're getting a branded message from someone, with some regularity, and
right.
Does it fit in that little square that identifies a sender of a tweet or Facebook message or something like that. But if you go back before that, there was a moment that I thought that sort of really represented kind of art in the service of political ideas in the United States, progressive political ideas, and that was like in the 30s, in the 20s, in the 30s particularly, under the New Deal programs that Franklin Roosevelt started, and he enlisted all these different art, well, not he, but the government at that point,
sure,
enlisted all these artists, like notably Lester Beale, but other ones as well, to first kind of create information graphics and exhortatory kind of inspirational messages about, you know, the progress that was being made under the New Deal programs, like the Rural Electrification Program and the Tennessee Valley Authority and all these different things. And those were represented by these really interesting, dynamic, and very simple kind of images.
Oh, everyone loves those Lester Beale posters. Are classic for a reason. And they you look at them and they look modern and dated at the same time.
Yeah, I know.
It's pretty impressive.
And they were simple for a reason. Simple because, you know, the sophistication and literacy of the audience was sort of like, you know, not guaranteed. They had this sort of just, you know.
Well, they didn't even have electricity.
Yeah,
hence
so it was sort of like,
yeah,
you know, be like a light bulb, electricity, good, arrow, and just like that. Simple. You know, and then another guy like is Charles Koyner, who came a little bit later, who did the National Recovery Act Eagle, the We Do Our Part Eagle. Then he did this amazing visionary system for the civil defense program that sort of had, you know, that ended up turning into bomb shelter symbols that we all, public bomb shelter symbols that I remember from growing up in the late 50s and early 60s. And just, again, beautiful, coherent, really clear, simple design. And I think, you know, oddly enough, if you go all the way up to the late 60s and into the 70s, you know, Richard Nixon, for whatever other faults or charms he had, was actually a great proponent, or at least his administration was a great proponent of design, particularly adopting kind of modern corporate identity to signal efficiency at the federal level. So that was the era where you had people like Shamar Geisner doing big federal projects, people like Damian Blackburn redesigning the NASA logo and doing the once reviled, now beloved NASA worm logo that
Everyone
thinks looks cool now, as opposed to the meatball logo, which everyone is sort of like suspicious of. But I think the, the public sector has had this on again, off again kind of relationship with the design world that, but now I think is sort of inescapable just because.
Yeah, you're right, because there's a different ways of communicating. Yeah. I mean, 1930s, what do you have a poster, you have a pin,
yeah,
and maybe you have a yard sign.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, whoever does any political party logo or anything for a national brand, I mean, that's got to go off onto teams of people.
And teams of people that include every supporter they have who will take it and make their own things with it. And, you know, probably should be encouraged to do that, you know, to show their allegiance.
Yeah, and I know, and part of it is also because then I assume is that they can hit demographics that the original designer would never have time to do or that they would never even think about.
Yeah, and also it's, you know, the idea of a single person. Well, I mean, I don't think at any point did a single person kind of control all these things, but I think if you just, you know, it's good old-fashioned kind of identity practice with some basic ingredients out there and kind of make them be the standard, you can kind of figure out a way to have consistency operating at one level, then variety and surprise operating at another level. So I think that's good for any organization.
And I assume you deal with that before. I mean, I know you work with Paula Scherer's team on the Chase Mark and stuff, or City Mark,
yeah.
City Mark. And that one, I mean, there's got to be just so many teams that touched it after you.
And even I'll work on small nonprofit projects and, you know, I'll judge the success of my own contribution with how sustainable it was after my role ended. Could the people that worked for my client keep using it in ways that were inventive and interesting and fun? And I've had some great success on a couple of occasions and some real discouragements in other cases. You do some nice work and it's sort of as good as long as it lasts, and then at the first opportunity it just turns into something not so hot. So
that I think we've all dealt with that. We did a logo for a local place that does like Olympic trampolines indoors.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing we saw was their little dance team like had hand drawn the logo on a board and had it in a picture, and it was like, that is cool. like of course it's massacred because it's like, you know, 10-year-olds redrawing the logo, but
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, wow, that is neat. But normally it goes the other way.
So. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, these days though, it's like I did a identity that launched for an educational institution back in early October, and by the end of the month, people were sending me pictures of it carved into pumpkins and stuff. And you know, I have to admit, I guess some people would look at that in horror and say they're not, you know, we didn't issue standards for pumpkin or other vegetable carving for this particular.
I can't believe you didn't add that into the guy. I mean, that's the standard. It's like, here's how it looks on a business card. Here's how it looks on the letterhead. Here's how it looks on a van. Here's how it looks on a pumpkin. Like, you've been in this profession long enough to know. I'm shocked that skipped. All right, we'll be right back with Michael Bayroot. Michael, actually, when we saw you speak on stage in probably Phoenix or something, you were running was that the first year of the Command X? Or no, that was the second time you guys started
in
Denver.
Yeah, the first year was in Denver.
And I think we were podcasting and we're like, man, this guy, how does this guy not have his own podcast? So you finally got your own podcast. What took you so long? Because everyone who's seen you present or speak about design know that you and Debbie Millman are like the naturals in this profession to be doing this.
Well, Debbie is a natural. Debbie is beautiful. She has a really musical, pleasant voice. She's really smart. She does her homework. Everything about her is perfect, in my opinion. I think I'm schlubby looking. I hear my own recorded voice, like many people. This is not just me, but I mean, I'm just like a lot of people. I hear my recorded voice and it just sounds like the most horrible, horrible thing in the world. I can't believe that people talk to me or make phone calls to me, never mind listen, willingly download a podcast or something. So, I was sort of always a little reluctant to take on that role. Even Command X series that we did for the AIGA, the Onstage America's Next Top Designer reality show type thing. When I was enlisted to sort of be the MC for it, I kept suggesting other people that I thought would be more suitable, you know, people that look better or more smoother, kind of look more like kind of game show hosts. And I know some of them that I think are like really perfect for the role. And, I said, okay, no one else will do it, I'll do it. And then they decided that I would, so I got a, I accepted that job. And I remember
you did three of those, right?
Yeah, I did the
Denver, Memphis, and
Nashville.
Phoenix.
Denver, Phoenix, and Nashville.
Okay.
What did you say? Maybe it was four. Maybe it was five. I don't know.
I think it was Memphis, not Nashville.
Oh yeah, Memphis, not Nashville.
They're close. It's
Memphis,
close.
Not Nashville. That's right. I have to. I did a little bit of like acting in high school. Not enough that I sort of like would call myself an actor, but enough to sort of like know that if people are like sitting in the audience and then a guy comes on stage, like something has to happen. It just can't, you know.
The direction to face, how to project the voice.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And so I remember that first time I went out in the as like the MC for this Command X game show, I like literally willed myself into having this like energy that was like really, I remember just thinking, you know, when I sort of like, it finally dawned on me like during the rehearsals that unlike every other thing at that conference, this is a recurring thing.
It became like the glue of the presentation.
So like, I think I sort of calculated that like, the MC of it like makes 9 separate entrances over the 2.5-day conference. And we had this theme music that sort of announced it. And I remember thinking, first time I said, if people don't like this, this music is going to have this Pavlovian effect of like, oh shit, it's happening again. This horrible thing that I hate. You know, and obviously you've seen some commercial you hate or any other irritating thing.
Right.
I mean, the first note of it just kind of makes you exasperated. And I just thought, I'm going to sell this thing so hard. So
you're in the back, like practicing door entrances, like Kramer?
I was like big energy, big energy. I was like really trying to pump myself up. So the character that actually I embodied was like not really, I wouldn't call it my real personality, but obviously some aspect of my personality. But it was, the thing that's amazing about something like that is the logic of the, three round elimination battle takes hold and it has its own inherent drama. And as, the deal gets whittled from 7 to 5 to 3 to 1, you come to identify, by the time you're down to those three, you sort of like feel like you know those three.
Right.
Right. And
you've been rooting for someone, you start placing bets. Yeah, we're gambling them off stage, right?
And so I was like really kind of in awe of the way that the system worked. Because it's actually, it's those things were, Emily Overman and Bonnie Siegler, who kind of it was their idea and they kind of put the thing together. They selected well, I think, when they picked their 7 original participants. After that, it just is sort of the audience imposing a dramatic narrative onto who's being eliminated and who's kind of like surviving. And you do it for your own entertainment the same way you would if you're watching, Bachelorette or Amazing Race or a political campaign. For that matter, it's all sort of the same thing. It's all different these days, sadly. It's all different forms of entertainment.
Well, you did find a replacement though the last time.
I thought I was getting too old to be convincing at it, and so it seemed like Mateo would be like I just said I'm stepping down after this, so they found Mateo, and I thought he'd be very suave, and so it takes him in a different direction, I think.
Yeah, and we're gonna have him on the show in a couple weeks, so he's recording. I think we'll be recording that one tomorrow. So we'll ask him.
He's got a voice that I could listen to forever, unlike that beautiful accent.
He probably didn't even practice walking on stage. He just walks into every room like that.
No, he's just
hair's flowing.
Suave,
yeah. Okay, well, you did a great job. It was a nice clue to the conference. So, what are you doing here at the How conference in Chicago? What are you speaking about?
I've got there's two sessions that I'm doing. One is a kind of up close and personal, kind of small scale case study that I'm doing with one of my favorite clients.
Small scale at How means there'll still be 500 people in this room.
Yeah, but it's the subject matter is actually.
Oh, okay.
It's not broad and sweeping. This first afternoon will be me and a woman named Robin Colangelo, who's the in-house creative director for a law firm in Manhattan, who we worked with on a project. We're just going to sort of describe what really happened in that project. So what's interesting about that to me is that unlike the kind of presentations I usually do, which are really carefully, they have to pass, at this stage of my life, if I'm showing something to an audience on stage, an audience of other designers who I think are really, that's an intimidating audience and it's a very discerning and judgmental one, the work that I'm showing has to, has to be inherently interesting, has to look really cool, has to have like a story behind it that kind of has some kind of narrative thrust to it. And those things are all kind of artificial. Anyone who's sort of any kind of speaker you admire who's a designer is sort of carefully editing what they're showing you, and it's not really kind of. Then if you compare it to what your own life is, you inevitably feel a little depressed because they seem to be just doing all this amazing stuff.
I mean, if you walked up there and presented on the PowerPoint presentations your team did for an hour, would just leave the room.
Yeah, exactly.
But that doesn't mean you don't do that work.
Yeah. And not only that, but that doesn't mean you don't take that work seriously, do it well, honor the people that commissioned it, honor the people that will use it. I mean, I think there's certain things that I think make, if you're entering design competitions, there's certain things that no matter how worthy or interesting or anything else they are, they just don't have that thing that makes them win design competitions.
Oh no, I fully understand.
They don't jump off the table.
I've been on both sides.
Yeah, exactly.
On both sides of the judging long enough, I've helped run shows. I've actually judged from shows. I've entered stuff, and I know how it works.
Yeah.
I mean, bigger is better. Screen printed is better. Letterpressed is better. I mean, or, but a lot of it is just who the client is makes a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not good, or it's not a good or bad thing. It's just, you need to understand who the audience is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, and it's hard to understand who the audience is sometimes. So when you're looking at work with someone, because unless you're the audience, you're going to have some imaginative leap, there'd be some magical leap involved before you pictured it. Would this thing work for me if I was an optometrist? If it's a thing directed towards optometrists, how would I know? You know, I'm not an optometrist. So I think, but this thing tomorrow, which is for a law firm, it's like not flashy, but it's like really solid, interesting work. And it's the kind of work that I think a lot of people in the audience will be able to kind of find a direct relationship to in the work that they do. So it's not necessarily, you know, gee whiz, I wish my life was different so I could do something that cool, which I think is, you know, I look at, when I go to a conference, that's my reaction to most of the presentations I
right.
see. I wish I could do something that cool. It's about all the stuff I'm doing is not cool. All the clients that keep rejecting.
How dare I take clients that might pay me?
Yeah. And so this is, me and Robin are going to do a kind of close study of just a particular engagement that we have. I hope it's of some value to the audience. And then, tomorrow, right after lunch, Jessica Helfand and I, with whom, who is with like me, one of the co-founders of Design Observer, are going to do this thing that we sort of decided we would do months and months and months ago, which is do this bi-monthly podcast and just record it live on stage. And so that, I hope that'll be interesting, but in front of a live audience, it might be fun, it might be exasperating. We'll have minimal slides on the screen because it's for radio. It's like a podcast, so it's
right.
not gonna, we can't really be talking about all the amazing visuals because it won't work on a podcast.
You can put a few in, but I know it's a pain. And,
yeah.
and half the people, I know a lot of the audience doesn't watch it in front
yeah,
of the computer
yeah.
and they just with the earbuds, so it's kind of pointless. Now, I guess we forgot to ask, where do people go to get your podcast?
It's on iTunes and it's on SoundCloud.
And what's the name of it?
Called The Observatory.
The Observatory?
Yeah.
And can we also find it? I assume you guys link to it on the Design
yeah, yeah,
Observer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Every time we launch a new one, it goes out, and then tweets and Facebook stuff and et cetera go out and announce it.
Now, Design Observer is now, what, like 11?
Yeah,
is that
12,
right?
12? 12 years, yeah.
12 years.
Yeah.
Wow, congratulations.
No, thank you.
That's like a century.
Yeah, it is.
You're like
bit,
the
yeah.
Coca-Cola of blogs or something.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, we'll be right back with Michael Bierut. So you've got an upcoming book on your work?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, after I held off for a long time doing this, partly.
Yeah, before. Now that I think about it, how have I not seen one before?
Yeah,
but I guess
it just seemed like work to me. That's all. And also I found it very unnerving to just like listening to your song, your own voice, kind of like laying out a book of your own work that you presume would be of interest to other people.
Plus, then you have the issue that you can't do any good work afterwards. You'd be like, damn it, why is this not in my book?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So there's that. Well, there's always a second expanded revised edition, I suppose. But so it's it is a very long title that I can't even say I have memorized for sure, but it's called something like How to Use Graphic Design to Sell Things, Explain Things, Make Things Look Better, Make People Laugh, Make People Cry, and Every Once in a While, Change the World.
Okay.
So that's the title of it.
So you got every keyword you can imagine in this book title.
Is that, I wasn't thinking that because I'm not
good.
An SEO kind of
okay,
guy. But,
okay.
But maybe that's, subliminally, maybe that's what I'm trying to do. But basically, it's
now,
just...
Now, who's publishing it? So where do we go to follow?
It's being published here in the United States by HarperCollins, by the Harper Design imprint of HarperCollins, in the UK by Thames and Hudson, and in Germany by Neagle. It'll be out in September, October.
Are you designing this yourself, or are you? Okay.
I design every page, and I wrote every word.
Okay, I didn't know, because I know a lot of times a lot of designers send that off to some, you know, work with someone else, because it's got to be an intimidating project.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's it is really intimidating, and the first few pages I was working on, I kind of was like this wincing and shuddering and sort of like, you know, it was like, you know, talking to my office about it, this was giving me the heebie-jeebies, just this whole page about, like, then I did this, and then I did that. It just sort of seemed like kind of, you know, is this worth the paper it's going to be printed on? But then I sort of, I think that once I sort of got into the groove, I actually bore down and got a real rhythm of, like, writing this thing. And, you know, it's 320 pages long, and they're big pages, and they're filled with stuff. So hopefully we see a little something for everyone in it.
Did you look at it as a design problem? Like, is there a narrative through it? Or
Yeah. Yeah, there's, it's basically, yeah, and it's funny because, you know, I think that books that designers, really graphic designers, do on their own work sometimes get a bad rap, and sometimes justifiably so. You know, I'm a graphic designer today because of a handful of books like that, you know, that really changed my life when I first saw them.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, like one was, you know, Strange Bedfellows. One was a book called Graphic Design Manual, Principles and Practice by Armin Hoffman, a very severe Swiss book that happened to be in my local suburban library in Ohio for some reason. Another one that had nearly the same title was Graphic Design by Milton Glaser. These are two books that was published in the mid-70s, and I got it as a gift from my parents, who otherwise knew very little about that world, except I was interested in it.
Right.
This is a time before the internet, a time before bookstores had big sections of stuff, and so, you know, that Milton Glaser book was like my whole world of graphic design.
Well, there's also something about it when you see a book, when you see, like, you know, the history of graphic design, it shows all this work, you don't, you know, it's a good broad thing, but when you see just one person's work, you really actually start to see, oh, there's, like, a career here.
Yeah.
There's not just, like, somebody did this post or somebody did this brochure and it's kind of pieced together. You're like, no, this is like one person can make a name and do a lot of work and have like thoughts behind it.
Yeah. And so when it came time to do mine, you know, having, you know, I was the designer and co-editor of the book that the late Tibor Kalman did, Tibor Kalman, Perverse Optimist. And he really didn't want that to be a normal monograph. He wanted it to be very, what was then avant-garde. So the text is almost all interviews with people who he worked with and other people. Some interviews with him, but also interviews with clients, interviews with people he worked with. Sort of undesigned in the way it's laid out, kind of discursive in terms of the order of it. Since then, you know, graphic design monographs have gotten more and more kind of deconstructed, both physically and in terms of the way they're organized. Mine is like really conventional. It has like chapters.
That's what I would expect from yours. I mean, you didn't have to explain that. The minute you said I got a book, I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it.
It's not like I dare you to figure this out. It's not like I'm going to disorient the hell out of you to blow your mind, and then, you know, when you're sitting there flabbergasted, I'm going to insinuate these bold new ideas. I just actually say, look, this is what one graphic designer does, and this is how I do it. And this is why I made these series of decisions. But then what I found, the thing that was kind of pleasing to me was I sort of have about 3 dozen kind of case histories I go through. And each one of them, I try to make be about some larger, each one of them is very specific and detailed, in some cases punishingly detailed about what it takes to do a certain kind of project.
I'm sure your editor loves going through those.
All my proofreaders claim to have found this like really amusing reading. Actually, so
okay,
they're
okay.
Lying to me, or they might just they might have to read more dull things than you and I can possibly imagine. But they seem to like it. But the you know, the details are for nerds like me. But then there's also some like larger points about, you know, really how graphic design specifically works. You know, how does it work? How does it fail? You know, how do we just use these tools that you and I know well, you know, typefaces and colors and shapes and how you juxtapose pictures and words and stuff like that. And how can you use that to accomplish different ends? You know, and I think, you know, my hope is that it can be read on that level too, where it's not just kind of like, you know, these individual things, but they're sort of talking about more general principles as well.
No, I look forward to seeing you. So that's coming out in October from HarperCollins.
Yeah.
All right. And you and Michael, people can go to find out more of your work at, do they just go to the Pentagram website, or do you have them follow you on?
I have a Twitter feed, which is at Michael Beirut, one word, that's B-I-E-R-U-T.
Oh, I miss fake Michael Beirut. It was only around for a month, but he was entertaining.
I know, yeah, my kids loved fake Michael Beirut on Twitter. They were really enthusiastic, to the point where I sort of thought they were me, actually, but... No, that was good, but
Were your kids, were they the ones who said, Dad, are you on Twitter? Is that how you found out?
I forget if it was them or someone at work or someone. I thought it was funny, though. So I've got that, I got a Facebook thing, and then Pentagram has a very active website at pentagram.com, and then Design Observer has a very well-followed Twitter feed and other things. So there's different ways you can sort of like follow this stuff. So.
And I saw in the bookstore down here your 79 essays on graphic design is in second printing or something?
Yeah. It's in paperback now, so each per essay, even cheaper unit price than before.
Well, they're older. I mean, blog posts, as they date, they just get cheaper and cheaper.
I think so. And I know there's ones that were old, like one of the earliest pieces of writing talks about doing design presentations using slide carousels, and it's not reminiscing about it, it's like talking about it as if this is how we all do it. And now, really, the only way most people know about that is from Mad Men, where it's like, Don Draper doing it.
When's the last time you actually did a Don Draper slide presentation?
I'm like a late adopter when it comes to technology. I have a flip phone instead of an iPhone, and I'm sort of like just waiting for it to break or for me to break it or lose it.
I can step on it right now.
You
I can help you out.
You think so? Really? Try.
Oh, just, forget those things are like bricks.
I know. Yeah, this thing is dropped.
I'll break my foot. I won't be able to walk the rest of the week.
Stay in an iPod, buddy. This thing is indestructible. Shaped like a bar of soap. It's like, slip right off from under your foot, I swear.
It always gets returned. Someone steals it and brings it back.
That's what's funny. Like, my wife, who hates it, my wife just thinks it makes me just really sort of obsessed with me, like, not having this thing anymore. Every time I lose it, she's, like, really gleeful. But then someone says, oh, I think I found your phone, sir. It's like, so then it comes back. So it's like herpes or something. It's just like this thing that is incurable. So at any rate, there's that. But also, I remember doing a slide presentation in late 2001 or early 2002. I remember doing a slide care. I think I was doing it into the 21st century, at least into early 2002. Because I can remember specific things that I did with these fan running on one of the projectors,
right,
and like a chunk of slides dropping in the shape.
Well, when Don Draper does it, it looks so cool. I understand why he wants to keep that going. But did you just quit? I mean, what happened? They just quit making slides on you, and then you're like, oh, I guess we have to move to the next thing? Or?
Like anything else, it's sort of, some people are avid for like the next new thing. And then some people just like wait forever. I'm one of those wait forever people. But then when I finally do, I'm like, wow, this is great. Why didn't anyone tell me about this? It's just so cool,
I tell you what, I wait normally till at least it's a version in or two, because the worst is when you adopt the first, there's always bugs.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, why do I have to deal with the bugs?
Exactly. So other people debug it, and also I like sort of the idea of having some shiny new thing that sort of like calls it. I'm just not a gadget person. I'm really not. Like, I really don't like stuff that much. Things. I sort of like, I like buying a nice pair of socks or something that makes me happy. But like some piece of digital communication, automobiles, all those things sort of.
Well, you're in New York. You don't need a car.
And so I live in the suburbs. I need a car.
Oh, okay.
So suburban. I've lived in the suburbs since 1984. So. Yeah, so but still, I'm not a.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in Omaha. You can't live in that city without a car.
Well, I'm from Omaha. I grew up in the Midwest too, so I know how that goes. But still, like to get from the airport to downtown Chicago, where we're speaking today, I took the train from the airport just because I find cars claustrophobic.
Actually. Oh, I did too. I think it's the cheapest thing you can. It's like $3.
Cheaper, yeah,
yeah,
it's cheaper.
It's great.
And if the traffic is bad, it's like really, you're following the same route as the traffic, so it's like passing people. It's great.
All right, Michael, thank you very much for your time. It's been talking to you. And we'll see you later in this conference. Good luck on the presentation, and and the live podcasting events.
We'll see how that goes, yeah.
All right.
Good. Yeah, Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
The Reflex Blue Show with Donovan Meary is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab.